Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I like to write on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture. And with me today is, of course, my co-host, Liz.
Hi, I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint.
Wonderful. And we have two guests with us today. I'd like to introduce my friend, Rosalyn. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Rosalyn Welch. I am a scholar of Latter-day Saint literature, scripture, and theology at the Maxwell Institute.
Fantastic. And Dennis, if you could introduce yourself, welcome aboard.
I'm Dennis Cutchins. I'm a professor of American literature, and I specialize in adaptation studies.
And we're glad to have you all here. Today, we're going to be talking about A Christmas Carol, a perennial holiday favorite that has been made and remade and rewritten many times. Each of us will be discussing some of our favorite versions of it, comparing them with each other, and discussing why this particular story has such an enduring holiday legacy. But first, our Best Books segment, where we each recommend one thing that we are watching, reading, or listening to. Listeners of the podcast will not be surprised at all to know that I am a geek and I enjoy all things nerdy. And I have finally started watching The Orville by Seth MacFarlane. And it's a faux Star Trek sort of wannabe thing. I've heard from my nerdy friends that it starts off being a comedy, but as it goes into its later seasons, if it just becomes more and more a ripoff of Star Trek, that in some ways is better than actual current Star Trek. And I can see that's true so far. I'm almost done with the first season, and the comedy is painfully out of place. And I'm like, why don't we just stop with all of that and just get to these really interesting, good moral dilemmas? The episode where you find out that this entire species is all male and a female is born to them. It was one of the best discussions I've seen of issues around consent of minors and even circumcision. And it was just a wonderful episode. And I was watching the whole thing going, stop making jokes. It's out of place. So I'm really enjoying it and looking forward to the future seasons where the comedy apparently slowly drops off as he bought his freedom from the machine and what he originally pitched. So my recommendation is Seth MacFarlane's The Orville, which you can find at various places, Disney Plus, Hulu, whatever else floats your boat. So that's what I've been watching recently. Liz, what have you been up to?
I was just going to say, Carl, I am glad to hear that because I watched through that episode, that particular episode that you mentioned, and I loved that episode, but I just couldn't do the humor. So maybe I will pick it back up because I gave up after the first season, but that sounds really good to me. I have a couple of podcast recommendations. I spend a lot of my time as a stay-at-home mom driving kids around in the car. So I have to have things that we can both stand to listen to. And quite a repertoire of kid podcasts, but I'm going to share three of my favorites with you. And if you are driving somewhere this holiday season, hopefully they'll help you out. The first one is called Forever Ago, and it's a history podcast for kids where they talk about the unusual history of things like lifeguards or the Rubik's Cube. And it's all done through narrative and skits. It's really fun and entertaining for the whole family. Lots of interesting history in there, and my kids love it. The next one is a little more educational, but also fun skits. It's called Million Bazillion, and it is a podcast by NPR that's a money podcast for kids. So they answer questions about credit cards and where does money come from and what are interest rates at a kid level.
Maybe I should be watching that one.
Yes, it's really good. Like, they boil it down. If you have to explain something to a kid, you have to understand it. And so they just do a fantastic job. And again, funny skits, just highly entertaining and informative. And then the last one is a podcast called Smash Boom Best. If you are or were a kid who likes to argue about stuff and which stuff is the best, this podcast is for you. It's a debate podcast. So they'll do things like unicorns versus dragons, or the sun versus the moon, or the last one we listened to was prickly pear plants versus redwood trees. And they have a little format where they do creative debate things with it, and then you decide who wins. So all three great podcasts for listening to in the car with your kids.
Thank you for those. I make my kids currently listen to my podcasts. So at some point, they're going to start rebelling. And maybe I will take a few of those, put them into my podcast feed when the rebellion comes, probably in the near future. Dennis, what have you been reading, watching, or listening to that you'd like to recommend to our podcast listeners?
So I'm teaching American novel right now as one of my classes. We finished Marilynne Robinson's Jack. I don't know if any of you have read Gilead. Yeah, it is a wonderful novel. And so this is one of the follow-ups for Gilead. There are several of them. This is one of the follow-ups for Gilead. And I quite enjoyed it. I can't tell if my students did or not. They tell me they do sometimes, but they don't. But it's thoroughly enjoyable. Hey, and as long as we're on the subject of Christmas Carol, I'm going to recommend, if you want to dig a little deeper into what we're talking about, I'm going to recommend Paul Davis's book, The Lives and Times of Ebenezer Scrooge, which is it's a hilarious, entertaining book, and I'll probably bring it up a little later in the podcast.
Thank you for those. Fantastic. Rosalind, what have you been reading or watching that you'd like to recommend to our podcast listeners?
First, I'll just say to Dennis, I loved Jack. I read it when it was released a couple of years ago. And one of the reasons I love it is because it's set in St. Louis, which is where I lived for almost 20 years. And there's a really memorable first scene that's set in the cemetery with Jack and Della. They're in the, goodness, what's the name of it? The Bell Fountain Cemetery, which is this iconic location in St. Louis. So I loved reading it just because I could recognize the settings. What I wanted to recommend doesn't exactly fall into the category of pop culture, but it's not quite as forbidding as I think it sounds often to potential readers, and that is Dickens's Bleak House. Since we're discussing A Christmas Carol today, I thought I'd just bring a little more Dickens to the party. I love Bleak House. It's probably my favorite book. Oftentimes, I would say it's my favorite book. I go back and forth, but it truly is Dickens working at his peak, at the peak of every artistic power he has, I think. And it has everything you love about Dickens with hilarious, memorable characters and with incredible comedy and comedic moments and satire. But it also has very deep emotional moorings. It has what I think is very interesting theological aspect to it. And narratively speaking, it's really fascinating. It has this kind of dual narrative voice that alternates between this really appealing female character, Esther Summerson, and then an omniscient narrator that we're accustomed to in Dickens. It's truly something special. The title sounds a little austere, Bleak House, but don't let that stop you from diving in.
Well, maybe I'm going to have to pick it up. I was an English major at BYU, and somehow all three times that I was in classes that studied Dickens, we read Hard Times. And I am Hard Times out, and I tapped out of Dickens after that, but maybe it's time to 15 years later, let some Dickens back in my life and try something new. So,
and I will say there is a nice television adaptation of Bleak House. I believe in 2005, I think the BBC did a miniseries version of it.
And that is a good point to transition to our main discussion about A Christmas Carol, because something that I did to prepare for the podcast was to go read it for the first time, I'm embarrassed to say. And I just had forgotten how good of an author Dickens is and how he can really paint a picture with words to put you in these various situations and help you feel the emotions of the people and paint the scene and set the stage for what he wants to present. And it was a delightful read. And so I wanted to start off, before we get to various adaptations of the story, just to generally talk about why we think this is such an enduring story. I'm going to let Rosalind take off on this one because she wrote an article in BYU Studies a few years ago called Culture Carol, Dickens' Influence on LDS Christmas Fiction, where she reviews a book of Christmas fiction by various LDS authors that kind of seemed like a greatest hits of 90s Mormon literature to me, Chris Heimerdinger and Jack Wayland and all the people that you might be familiar with from that time, and why there were within that book so many discussions and adaptations of A Christmas Carol and why it resonates with us. But of course, since there are, like, I think we counted, there were 13 film adaptations of the movie since the original one in 1935. Obviously, this story has some enduring legacy for not just Latter-day Saints, but people of good faith all over the world. And I wanted to sort of get everybody's thoughts on that. But Rosalind, I'll let you lead off on that.
If you just read A Christmas Carol for the first time, Carl, I have read A Christmas Carol almost every year since my childhood. My father used to read it to us every Christmas season. It's like the Book of Mormon. I know that first stayed really well. And then as the season got away from us and we ran out of time, we could skip and go quickly through the end of it. But it's become a sacred text to me and my family. We read it every Christmas. I now read it to my children every Christmas. I know it, so many of its words and phrases and its images by heart. And its cadences really are the sound of the season for me. So when I was in graduate school, you were too kind. You said that this article was published just a few years ago. It actually was published in 2001. Which makes me feel very old.
That was 2 years ago?
I was in graduate school and somehow got interested in this and wrote this article, and it was published in BYU Studies. I think it was the first academic article I ever published. So it was really fun to go back and revisit it and think about it again. And it's such a good question you ask, and I love your approach on this podcast, which is what makes this story so useful and so appealing in our culture? What allows it to be repurposed and retold and re-understood and re-loved over and over again? In some ways, it had a very specific origin. Dickens, in 1843, had read a report that was issued by the government on the condition of child laborers in mines and factories. And it was graphically illustrated to show the misery and the suffering of these child laborers. Dickens had such a warm and open heart, and he was devastated by this, and he was determined to do something about it. And so he was going to write a sledgehammer that would come down with 20 times the force on the nation of England. And that was A Christmas Carol. So he wrote this with a very specific intention, which was to awaken the soul and the minds of his countrymen to the plight of poor, and in particular, poor children. So we can see this, of course, in these figures of ignorance and want that emerge from underneath the skirts of the ghost of Christmas yet to come near the end of the story. And also, of course, in the figure of Tiny Tim. Dickens has a way of pulling at our heartstrings with a kind of pathos that could be sentimental and it could be cheap, but it never is when Dickens does it. It comes and it lands with real emotional weight. So that was the very kind of specific origin of this tale. But of course, it has very mythological and archetypical roots, even beyond that. At heart, it's a conversion story, isn't it? It's a conversion story. And in that way, it builds on the story of Saul and his conversion to Christ on the road to Damascus in this biblical text that is so resonant in Christian cultures. And it builds on A Pilgrim's Progress, which is another story of a kind of everyman who undergoes a conversion. So the bones of this story, of this conversion story, somebody who goes from darkness to light through a kind of encounter with something larger than himself, an encounter with God in one way or another, is a very deep and archetypal form that can be reimagined and can be filled out. Its categories can be filled out very specifically according to whatever moment or whatever culture is taking it up. And we see that, of course, as we've been talking about and as we'll talk about more, the way that these archetypal figures and experiences can get filled with the anxieties, the preoccupations, the interests, and just the detail of any different moment in time. So in this article, I looked in particular at this volume of Christmas short stories that Deseret Book published in 1997. It was called Once Upon a Christmas Time. And if I'm not mistaken, Deseret Book did a number of these volumes over several years. And I'm not sure whether those are still in print or if they're still putting them out.
They're still available through DeseretBook.com, but I think just in like ebook format. But they're still there if you want to go pick them up.
Yeah. So I looked at all these stories. I read them and read them as updated adaptations, retellings of the Scrooge story, of A Christmas Carol. And truly, almost to a story, each one of them replicated in either broadly or sometimes in very specific and knowing ways. They repeated the story of Scrooge's conversion. But there were some interesting differences as well. I won't go through them all. One of them, for Dickens, the main problem to be overcome is the kind of economic dislocation that urbanization had caused in Victorian England, right? Whereas once it seemed to him English society had been united and unified in this kind of old past, a manorial past where there was a feudal lord who was related and took care of the workers on his manor, right, through bonds of charity and noblesse oblige. With the great urbanization that occurred in the migration to the cities, those traditional bonds had been broken. So there was this kind of alienation, and the rich no longer feel responsibility for the poor, right? This is a major theme in A Christmas Carol, is that the rich feel no responsibility for the poor, and the poor are suffering because of it. So in these Latter-day Saint versions, there's a very different kind of dislocation that's happening. It's very often the breakdown of the nuclear family. So you see divorced couples, you see widowed protagonists, you see characters who are away from their families for one reason or another. So our anxieties around the fragility of the family kind of substitute for Dickens's anxieties around the fragility of social bonds in cities. The same basic archetypal form can get re-expressed to work out the problems and express the values of a new moment. And for us as Latter-day Saints, those values center around the gospel of Jesus Christ. And oftentimes, Scrooge's conversion or the Scrooge character's conversion is a conversion to the gospel, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And sometimes it's more subtle, but it's often mediated through the church. Lots of visiting teachers and home teachers, as they were called back then, show up and people work through what are the bounds of duty-bound charity versus charity that comes from the heart. So we work through these cultural practices that we share, ultimately with the goal of uniting families and uniting ward families in genuine bonds of love that heal us. So you see the same kind of healing and conversion that takes place in Scrooge. That's a universal feature of these Christmas stories, that on Christmas morning, the protagonist wakes up and is whole and is healed and is reintegrated with his or her family and is filled with the spirit of Christmas. So those are a few of my observations. I don't want to keep going and going. Those were a few of my observations from surveying kind of what's out there in terms of short story adaptations of A Christmas Carol.
I like that a lot, that it's both a conversion story and also a story of reconnecting with society, starting out with alienation and ending with connection. And maybe that's why it's such a powerful Christmas story, those two elements together. It's an interior story, but it's also an exterior story of reconnecting with your culture, your society, your family.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this fantastic line at the beginning where, you know, Scrooge was Marley's sole friend, sole mourner, sole executor, sole partner, right? Just emphasizing, of course, there's a pun there on S-O-L-E and S-O-U-L, mm-hmm. but emphasizing his separateness. And yet he is connected to Marley, right? In fact, the two of them are linked in these symbolic ways throughout, but he just doesn't recognize his connection there. So part of his conversion is coming to recognize the connection that's already there. And he comes to understand himself in the end as a second father to Tiny Tim, Dickens tells us. So he finds himself reintegrated into a family and these bonds of responsibility and care are restored.
Yeah, we'll get to the versions that I watched and wanted to. But in one of them, I like that at the end, as he's had his conversion story, he's given the goose to the Cratchits and all the things. He's getting ready to go to lunch with his nephew and his family. And he speaks to the door knocker as if it were Marley. And I liked that version that he was reconnecting with him. Part of me felt bad. I'm like, oh, sorry, Marley. Nobody came to visit you and change you. You got to wear your chains for all eternity. But you got to come and talk to Scrooge. But I liked that Scrooge had a moment where he talked to the door knocker and put a little Father Christmas beard on the door knocker and said, thank you, Marley. And it was a nice moment. There are so many facets of the story, different ways you can tell it, different versions that emphasize different of the relationships and how they are repaired and healed through this thing. I enjoy it.
Such a lovely moment. I'll just underline that, Carl. I didn't see that moment, but it fits in so well with the themes of the story. And that repentance can work backwards in time as well, can change the way that we interpret our past. And how lovely is that, that Scrooge has now been able to re-understand his relationship with Marley as something much deeper than just a business partner, but as a friend and as a brother.
Yeah, yeah. That's the C.S. Lewis quote, right? For those who choose heaven, they will say we've always been there. And for those who have chosen hell, they'll say we've always been in hell.
Good. We got our C.S. Lewis reference.
We got a C.S. Lewis quote. And once again, you didn't bring it up, Liz. So there you go. Dennis, I'm curious what your thoughts are on what makes this story so adaptable and irresistible for screenwriters, because I think most of the rest of the podcast is going to be about different screen or film versions of A Christmas Carol. So wanted to get your thoughts before we moved into that portion of the podcast.
I will say, I'll add one thing to maybe a couple of things to what Rosalind had suggested. And one of them is that this was a very personal story for Dickens. As a kid, his father had ended up in poor jail and prison. And Dickens ended up having to work at a shoe blacking factory, a shoe polish, basically, putting labels on these bottles. And he didn't work there very long, but he worked long enough to know he never wanted to do it again. And so when he read the report that Rosalind mentioned, it hit him very personally. It was something that he felt very badly about, and he wanted other people to feel badly about it too.
That is in that film, The Man Who Invented Christmas, right? It portrays that relationship between the story, which is a very interesting movie.
So I'm going to suggest a couple of things, but before, I just want to reiterate how attractive it is. So Dickens wrote this, and I think they published 5,000 copies, and they sold out very quickly. And he had already sold 2,000 more copies, and they were in the process of publishing those. They were not inexpensive. They were relatively cheap. It would have been almost half a week's wages for Bob Cratchit to buy a copy of A Christmas Carol. So it was a handsome book. It was meant to be a gift book. But other publishers quickly began copying the book. Copyright laws were weak. And so there was that. And part of that is driven absolutely by money. These guys knew they could make a copy. It would cost a few cents, a few pennies. It would be a cheap knockoff, right? It wouldn't have the color illustrations and the other things that Dickens' book had. But they knew they could make money from it. So this came out just before Christmas, 1843, if I'm remembering right. And by February of, so we're talking maybe 3 months, there were no fewer than 8 stage adaptations, either on stage or in process. And I think Dickens was mildly irritated is an understatement, but he had mixed feelings, right? He was really excited that people loved it, but he was also really sad that he wasn't making money from it and that people were missing the point of this, which was, hey, there are poor people out there suffering and you guys aren't helping. To get to your question, the thing that strikes me about why this is so popular is because it holds out the hope for change. People ask me, what is the good news in the gospel? If they don't ask me, I tell them anyway, what is the good news in the gospel? And for me, the good news has always been that you can change, that it's never too late. That's really the baseline message of this, is that you can be as bad as Scrooge and still change. And a lot of the adaptations have ratcheted that up with every sort of new adaptation. They've said, okay, we'll make Scrooge even worse in this one. So if you think of, I think Bill Murray's sort of crazy television executive or Scrooge McDuck. So each one makes it worse, makes Scrooge worse so that his eventual redemption is better, is even more moving. Carl, there's my answer to your question. It's about the possibility of change, even for the very worst of us.
And I'll just add to that, if I can, there's this beautiful woman that I think is probably reproduced in every adaptation, but where he wakes up on Christmas morning and he's giggling like a child, right? And he says, I'm a child, I'm a child, I'm quite a child. So that change is specifically a rebirth, right? It's a rebirth. Yeah. It's ironic that we see the inside of many different stores in A Christmas Carol. We never see the inside of a church, although we hear about people going to church. So it's deeply Christian in its themes, although Dickens has an ambivalent relationship to the church, which comes out in A Christmas Carol, but certainly in his depiction of this change that's possible, it's deeply Christian in that idea of a rebirth.
Yeah, that was actually something that I myself noticed. I'm going to bring this up and then we'll move into our discussion of the various versions, that Jesus is almost absent entirely from this, from almost every version. There is a nice moment in the actual book where Tiny Tim, and this showed up in the 1935 version, one of the ones that I reviewed for the podcast, where Tiny Tim says, oh, I thought it would be nice if the people could see me as a cripple so they could remember he who helped the lame to walk and the blind to see. So there's this little moment where Christ appears. And then at one point, when Scrooge visits his nephew's party with the ghost of Christmas present, there's a little line that says, and after a while, they played at forfeits, for it is good to be children sometimes and never better than at Christmas. when its mighty founder was a child himself. But those are the only two references to Christ in the various versions that I reviewed for the podcast. And that was interesting to me. There's an ongoing sort of fight on this podcast about what exactly our rating system is for when we talk about gospel connections. Because when we get to that, try to say, I'm only going to give something 5 apricots if there's an explicitly sort of gospel Christian message. And I'd have to say, I don't know that the Christmas Carol counts.
You are about to say a Scrooge thing. I could see it coming. You are keeping those apricots. You need to give them away, baby.
But I agree with what you're saying, Carl. I think another piece of why Christmas Carol keeps getting adapted is because it comes just about as close as you can get to doing a religious Christmas story without doing a religious Christmas story. And so it enables you to reach a mass audience of people who aren't necessarily interested in a Christian film, but not do something commercial. So it's a very moral story. It walks right up to that line.
And that was Dickens' whole purpose, right? Because if he had made this an explicitly Christian story, there were plenty of those, right? And it would have been too easy for people, I think, to set it aside. And so instead of the Holy Ghost, he has these weird sort of magical spirits, right, who come down and haunt Scrooge. And yeah, I think it is, Liz, I think that's really insightful, because I think that was part of his purpose, was to make a Christmas story that wasn't necessarily about Christ, but was. Carl, in your stingy apricot keeper.
It still gets 4 out of 5 apricots, but that's sort of where it ends up going.
Dickens was allergic to overtly pious characters. Some of his best satire comes when he is taking down hypocritical, pious, pompous preachers and the self-righteous, right? He cannot stand self-righteousness. And I think he harbored bitterness against the high and mighty who saw themselves as so Christian and so enlightened and blamed the poor for their own predicament, right? Provoked his ire like almost nothing else was to blame the poor, when the pious and wealthy blame the poor for their own predicament. And there's this amazing scene in A Christmas Carol where all the wealthy and well-to-do, in fact, are on their way to church. And at that moment, you see the poor coming out of their homes with their turkeys that they can only bake in the bakeries when the bakeries are done, when their ovens are cleared for the pies and the delicacies for the rich kitchens and the full tables, then the poor can go and bake their turkeys while the ovens are still hot there. So he has these subtle moments of critique here of times when Christianity can actually be harmful, right? When we use it as an excuse and we become self-righteous and we blame the poor and say that they're poor because they're sinful, or we just depend on Jesus to fix it all and we don't feel our own complicity and we don't feel ourselves convicted in the injustice that we see around us.
So he has that scene right at the very beginning with the two men who come collecting charity offerings, and Scrooge's response is, are there no more poorhouses? Have they closed all the prisons? Then what's the problem? Because that's where the poor people need to go.
I'm hearing in my head the Living Scriptures Alma say, the poor are poor because they are lazy. If I work more, I should have more. That's what I'm hearing. And I think it also works from the other direction of sometimes religious people are hesitant about doing Christmas stories that are explicitly about Christ that adapt the scriptures. We want to just read Luke 2. And so it is a little safer also to do something that isn't explicitly scriptural, where you're going to offend people if you get it doctrinally off. So both sides happy with Christmas Carol, and we all meet in the middle and just keep making Christmas Carol adaptation.
That's right. And that was something that amazed me as I went to just Amazon Prime and typed in A Christmas Carol, because I was like, which versions am I going to watch for this? And like 40 of them came up. I wrote down Mr. Magoo, Barbie, Flintstones, Smurfs, Looney Tunes, the Mickey Mouse one, of course. There's a new Netflix one that comes out on December 2nd.
Do you even have a sitcom if you didn't have A Christmas Carol episode?
Scooby-Doo has a Christmas Carol version, and of course they do, because they're ghosts. And House had a Christmas Carol episode. X-Files had a Christmas Carol episode. Like, everybody does their Christmas Carol version.
I didn't watch one, but there was one that was explicitly like, this is a Christmas Carol, but we're going to really lean into the horror elements of it. And I think I'm going to go back and watch that one later. There are just so many versions of it. So Let's transition now, though, and talk about the versions that we have enjoyed and that we have watched. Rosalind's done a great job of talking about this particular volume of Latter-day Saint literature, sort of adaptations of Christmas Carol. But there are a lot of film versions or TV versions, and we wanted to talk about those and compare and contrast them to continue the conversation about what makes a good adaptation of this story, now that we've talked in broad strokes about the universal nature of why people like it so much. Liz, I'm going to let you go first. You wanted to go ahead with whichever one you wanted to start with.
I have to preach the gospel of the Patrick Stewart one-man audio play. If you have not listened to this, you're missing out. It's another great thing to listen to in the car or while you're wrapping presents. It's divided up into three or four 30-minute segments. It used to be two cassette tapes, and you flip it over. He does all the voices himself, and a lot of the text is from Dickens, but it's shorter and adapted. It's a Christmas tradition for me to listen to it, and just I love hearing the language, and Patrick Stewart is such a great actor. He does all the parts himself, and he does the sound effects. He does the clocks and the bells, and it's just amazing. But there is a movie version as well with Patrick Stewart, and I find it very interesting. It's very Victorian. Patrick Stewart's a very Shakespearean actor, and so I felt like he tried to be very period. The costumes are very close to what is described in the book, down to you don't usually see the Ghost of Christmas Present with his cape, or his coat is supposed to reveal his breast. So it is like down to his belly button. You can see his chest. And the Ghost of Christmas Present looks very candle-like, and he's young and old, uncanniness. And the one thing I really enjoy about it, even though it's not my favorite version video-wise, audio version I will hold till my dying day, I like that it includes a lot of details that aren't in a lot of adaptations. Scrooge snuffing out the Ghost of Christmas Past with the hat like a candle. That's just a weird thing that doesn't make it in. Has the flight with the Ghost of Christmas Present where they go see the people at the lighthouse and on a boat and in a mine. It has ignorance and want, which is one of my must-haves for a good adaptation, including that part. Like often, it's not in a lot of versions because it is very preachy, but it's very Dickens to have this social justice message. So I think it's really important. And then, interestingly, this one actually does, and the audiobook also has Scrooge going to church at the end. And he sings, God rest you merry gentlemen. And he goes into the church and sits down with his fellow man. And this is part of the reconnection that we talked about earlier, that he's rejoining the fabric of society, being part of the church, not in a religious conversion necessarily, but he's participating with his fellow. That's an interesting choice. It doesn't make it into a lot of versions. So that's the 1999, I believe it's a Hallmark movie, like a made-for-TV movie with Patrick Stewart. And then the audiobook version, which is available on Audible, and you should all buy it right now. It's well worth the credit.
Excellent. Dennis, you went and saw Spirited this weekend with your wife, and you wanted to talk about that one.
I'm going to give you a review of Spirited because I'll wait for just a second. I just wanted to say that I think my favorite is, am I stealing somebody's thunder? Is anybody else talking about the 1951?
Is that the Alistair Sim? Yeah, we're going to get
that. That's Alistair Sim. And that's probably my favorite. I love that. And so if you haven't seen that one's probably worth seeing. The one that I grew up with is actually Scrooge, right? Which was a 1970 musical, which tells you.
Which I am going to talk about.
Okay. So I won't say much about that one, except that one's scared. Sorry to do this. That one scared the dickens out of me. Scene at the end of that one where Scrooge falls into the grave, and it was terrifying. I was absolutely terrified as a little kid watching that one in the theater. Okay, so here's the story. Knowing that we were going to do this podcast, I had seen that this Spirited film was made. It was made by Apple TV. It's on limited release right now in theaters. So there are theaters here in our little town in Provo where it's showing, but I think it's got a broad release. I'm not a real Will Ferrell fan, and I'm not a real Ryan Reynolds fan either, for that matter. But I mentioned to my wife, I was going to see this one. It's a musical. I don't know. And she said, yeah, let's go. So we had a date night. We went and did the date night thing and saw the movie. And she has a zero tolerance policy for Will Ferrell. It just just FYI. And if she knew Ryan Reynolds more, she would have a zero tolerance policy for Ryan Reynolds. But we went, we watched the film, and at the end, she turned to me and said, I want the soundtrack for Christmas. Will you get me the soundtrack? I'm just going to say, this is my gentle push to say, I think you might enjoy it, even if you're not a fan of Will Ferrell or Ryan Reynolds. It's an actual musical with plenty of songs and plenty of dancing, and it's a real musical. Now, if the thought of Will Ferrell dancing makes you a little worried, I'll just say there are also real dancers who are dancing there in the background who are doing much more complicated things. It was thoroughly enjoyable, and the music was super fun. One of the best songs in the most memorable songs is called Good Afternoon. And if you remember, when the two guys come asking for a donation, Scrooge says, good afternoon to them like five times. And so this film takes that and runs with it and makes a very funny song called Good Afternoon. In the middle of the movie, there's a family sitting like four seats down from us, five seats down from us. And there's a little girl, she's probably four, sitting there watching the film. And in the middle of the film, I look over and she is totally rocking out. She is literally dancing in her seat, and she stands up and she starts dancing. And I thought, what more do you want from a movie? If a four-year-old can dance to it, then what more do you want? It's pretty kid-friendly. I would say just pretty toned down, especially for a Will Ferrell or Ryan Reynolds movie. And if my wife liked it, then it had to be pretty good.
Yeah. I think you said you saw it too, Liz.
Yeah, I saw it as well. And it's an interesting premise. I don't want to ruin too much of it because it is so new, but...
Liz is keeping the apricots again. Liz, come on.
Okay, I'll tell you a little bit. The premise is that Christmas Carol is like a thing that happens every year, that this team of people goes out and finds some crappy person and they research them all year and they give them the Christmas Carol experience and fix them. And then this year they pick someone who's a real doozy and things go wrong, horribly, horribly wrong. So yes, it's quite fun. Very tongue-in-cheek and meta on the Christmas Carol stuff, but it hits all the essential points. And yes, Good Afternoon was absolutely the best song.
Actually sounds delightful, but and that's what's so fun about seeing that might be then maybe the only adaptation we talk about that is a really true reimagining of the bare bones minimum of the story, because all the rest of them I think we're talking about are pretty faithful adaptations with the little tweaks here and there. And the idea that there are three spirits or however many that are assigned to do this once a year,
well, it's a whole bureaucratic process. There's like a department.
That's great. Oh, boy. One of the ones that I watched for this podcast was the 1935 one, just the original one. You can find it in various places. I rented it from iTunes and then found out that it was available for free on Amazon Prime. Just to check all your sources before you start paying money for this stuff. And this is the one where it showed Bob Cratchit and Tiny Tim leaving the church. And that was the first inkling that I was like, oh, yeah, there's nothing explicitly religious about it. Like Dickens could have written A Christmas Carol in a parallel universe. We were all celebrating like Saturnalia or something. And that made me long a little bit for that. But we've already belabored that point, and that was interesting to me. But I also enjoyed the thing that I found most fun is when with the ghost of Christmas present, he goes and sees the girl that he broke up with, the ghost of Christmas past. And he sees her family, and the family is impossibly large. Like they have 20 kids running around all under the age of 15. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's not like you couldn't have done. Anyway, but it just showed the joy that family now has, which is, again, hinted at in the novel with all the different kids running around. And Dickens does a really good job. And I like your word, Rosalind, the cadence of the writing to show the chaos of this as they're losing shoes and running into each other and just chaos and chaos. But the mother and the father are there just enjoying the whole thing. And Scrooge has this real moment where he realizes that he's just so lonely and bitter in this like cold, dark apartment that he has himself. And to see a family portrayed so well and vibrantly felt very, I don't know, Latter-day Saint to me. except that it was probably a little over the top with the number of kids. So maybe the extended family when they all get together Christmas morning in my family.
Or just polygamists.
Sure, fine. If you want to.
There's a spin on Christmas Carol we haven't done yet. Or 1850s Utah, let's go.
1850s. Someone get on that. Some one of our readers with lots of money. You should totally make that adaptation. That would be killer. Oh, boy. And so it was fun to see that even, and it was colorized, even though the original in 1935 was obviously originally done in black and white. And you could tell the actors are used to being on stage, like you get with a lot of those sort of early black and white movies as they transition from stage to cinema as the dominant storytelling live art form. But it was fun and just a moment to me to see that how early on in cinema, people were adapting this story. And they haven't stopped since. And it was fun. It's an hour long. It's not a super huge commitment, but I really enjoyed it. And the thing that was also interesting to me is that they never showed Marley. He just has a conversation with this off-screen person. You could tell he's terrified. And so that was an interesting choice that, to me, lent an air of panic to the Scrooge character, the actor's portrayal of Scrooge, that he's seeing this terrifying thing. It just freaks him out so much, but we as the audience never get to see it. They talk about show not telling when you're writing, but in a good horror movie, you never show the monster, and they didn't this time. And so that was a fun adaptation for me to have watched. Liz, we talked about the Alistair Sim one a little bit, but Liz, that was one that you watched that you wanted to bring up a little bit. So tell us about that one real quick.
Yeah, I've long been curious about this 1951 adaptation with Alistair Sim because on a couple different lists of best Christmas Carol adaptations, this one hits the number one spot. And I was like, what? How can this beat out the Muppets? I don't know. So I went in very skeptical. Apparently, when I told my mom I was watching this, she's, oh, yeah, that's the version I watched growing up. So maybe there's some nostalgia factor in there for the people making the list. Like the version of Christmas Carol I grew up with is the right one, obviously. But I found it has some really interesting things. There's a lot of added backstory to Scrooge that they put in here, which had me going, wait, did I miss part of the original novella? Because it really fit really well. So Scrooge gets hired away from Fezziwig by this dishonest businessman who introduces him to Marley at his firm. And this Jorkin is the dishonest businessman. He buys out Fezziwig, and Scrooge and Marley cut the wages of all of Fezziwig's former staff. And then it turns out that Jorkin's been embezzling company funds and avoids prosecution because it would look bad for the company, so no one will prosecute him. And Scrooge and Marley bail out the company and gain control of it. So there's this whole interesting like business machinations and really showing how Scrooge went from being a nice clerk at Fezziwig's and just enjoying his life and like, gradually gets led into corruption and thinking money, 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 and not caring about the employees. So that was very interesting. And there's also a deathbed scene where Scrooge goes to Marley's deathbed and Marley has like a deathbed repentance. What have I done? You should stop and change. And Scrooge is like, what? I don't get it. The whole time. It was interesting. So there's some interesting different backstory in there. Alistair Sim's acting is definitely a style choice. I don't know if it's just 50s acting, but it did not land with me to be a number one spot. But still, I thought the backstory stuff was very interesting. And it also follows his ex-fiancee in the present. And you see her and her family that she now has. So that's another common element. But interesting adaptation. It's available to stream on a couple of different free apps if you want to watch it with commercials.
So you're thinking a leveraged buyout of a huge company right around Christmas time, that there might be connections to contemporary life for us there.
I just found it so interesting to really think about how a career in business corrupts someone and like this depiction of moving from being at a small firm, like Rosalind was talking about the era, right? Fezziwig's was portrayed as this small firm that cared about the people, and he wasn't going for maximum profit. He was just enjoying the amount of business he was able to handle on his own. He didn't want to grow and become a franchise or anything. And then the new guy comes in who's this new attitude of, we're going to leverage everything for as much as we possibly can. The goal is to make money, cut the wages as much as possible, and just make profits for the shareholders. Just explicit contrast of those two philosophies is really interesting.
Dickens had such a split view of commerce, right? On the one hand, Some of the scenes of the greatest fellowship and abundance and goodwill and warmth happen in stores. He really kind of sentimentalizes the commerce of Christmas time and the abundant produce, and everybody's in a good mood and everybody's happy. And the act of shopping becomes this expression of fellow feeling. And then you compare that to Scrooge's world and the world of the exchange, right? Scrooge's word is good upon change, he says, where the values of kind of greed and exploitation rule. So he had a very kind of split vision. I'm not sure economists would really endorse that or sign off on, but socially speaking, for him, it was always a question of relationships and of fellow feeling. And for him, at that kind of level of the shopkeeper, he could see that fellow feeling in action. For him, the level of the stock exchange and the high finance and the world of buying and selling and trading financial instruments, for him, was a soulless place of greed and alienation.
And some things haven't changed since the 1840s.
No names mentioned.
No names mentioned. No. The poor are always with us, as the Lord said, and so are some of the themes that surround them. Yeah.
So I'm going to throw in one more book, maybe one and a half books. I throw them in sparingly. I don't know if you've ever read any of David Sedaris's books, but he has a book. It's in it. He has a character who reviews elementary school productions of Christmas shows. And it's one of the, I kid you not, it is one of the funniest things I've ever read. It's from this book. It's called David Sedaris' Holidays on Ice. And in it, he has a character who reviews the Jane Snow Hernandez Middle School production of A Christmas Carol. It's not very long, and I'm not going to give a blanket endorsement to David Sedaris, but that's one of the funniest things I've ever read.
Are we going to talk about The Muppet Christmas Carol?
We're going to end with that one. So let me talk really quickly.
We don't need to talk about that one. Nobody's even seen that one. Nobody likes that one.
Like, at the end of the episode, we pitch what we're doing next time. We said, so we're going to talk about A Christmas Carol and why the Muppets version is the best one.
I've taught A Christmas Carol a couple of times in class, and that's the only one my students want to talk about is the Muppets Christmas Carol.
That's part of, I hope, the purpose of this particular episode of our podcast is to get people out of the Muppets and thinking about the story as a broader thing. My wife and my mother-in-law are both hugely into musicals. So they both convinced me that the 1970 version would be really fun. And it was. The thing that I enjoyed the most about it, which you couldn't do as well in a non-musical setting. This is an area where I think the genre of the musical does a really good job of telling this particular story of Scrooge's conversion. Is there are a couple of songs about Scrooge when he's Scrooge, when he's a miserly, penny-pinching person that everybody loves to hate. The children all sing a song about him, and they call him Father Christmas, and it's just completely dripping with sarcasm because he is obviously not a Father Christmas. And then when he visits with the ghost of Christmas future, he visits all the people who are singing over the fact that he has died, and therefore, like, all their debts have...
Isn't that Thank You Very Much?
Yeah, and it's so hilarious because Scrooge is there, so happy that he has done this thing that makes all these people so happy. And he's singing and dancing around. And he doesn't see them walk behind him with his coffin to go put it on the hearse. And it's just this great little moment. But then at the end of the movie, when he has had his conversion moment and he's running around buying all the toys and the turkeys and just giving money away left and right, whatever else, they sing reprises of Father Christmas and Thank You Very Much that completely change. They are reprises, so they completely flip what was Scrooge on his head. And it was just so touching to me because it showed to me not just what you were talking about earlier, Rosalind, about how repentance and change are universal themes that are cross-cultural, but the effect that your repentance can have on others around you was, I think, really well portrayed by this 1970 musical version. And it was because they were doing reprises of these old songs. I don't know that it would have worked in a different genre the same way. And so I went upstairs after I watched it, and my wife was like, so how did you like it? Because she knows that I'm not a musical fan. And I sheepishly had to bow my head and say, I think this might be my favorite film version of the story now. And she was like, I've converted you. I'm like, you've converted me to one musical, not to musicals. But that's a discussion for Susan and I to have off camera.
All right, that's it. More musicals in season two of the podcast. Got it.
Did you hear him giving away those apricots like they were just going out of style? That was lovely.
Those are popcorn balls for merit, but yeah. Like, it's a great version. I had a really fun time watching it. And so it was quite fun. But all right, let's end with the discussion of the Muppets, because of course we got to talk about this one, which is a perennial favorite, even though we watched the Mickey Mouse Christmas Carol one, and I thought that was quite fun with my kids, though. I did have to look up when Scrooge McDuck was an actual character. It turns out he was made in like 1947. I was unclear when he appeared in the pantheon of Donald Duck's sort of villains.
They're great comic books of Scrooge McDuck. If you have advanced readers, those are a great source for them if you can find them at your library, because they're very advanced in text, but it's basically DuckTales. It's great.
So they invented Scrooge McDuck in 1947, and then when they did the adaptation in 1983, the animated Mickey Mouse A Christmas Carol, they're like, oh, we'll just take this guy who we named after the character anyway and just slot him in to that character position. And so that's interesting. But Liz, you take it away. What do you like about the Muppets so much?
Right? Arguably, Muppet Christmas Carol should not work, but it does. It so works, and we all love it. I'm stealing these arguments from an article from the movie review site called Bright Wall Dark Room. They have an article called A Grand Yuletide Theory, The Muppet Christmas Carol is the Best Adaptation of A Christmas Carol. And they make two good arguments about why Muppet Christmas Carol works. And this is going to fit in really well because they're both things that Rosalind mentioned.
Is one of the arguments Michael Caine?
They do talk about Michael Caine. No, but this one is actually about Gonzo, because Christmas Carol is written in the first person. And Dickens is just showing off left and right with his narrative flourishes. And that's one of the hardest things to convey in a Christmas Carol adaptation, right? Is you don't have the narration. Every version tries to cram the narration in somehow. There's some voiceovers, or we transform it into lines of dialogue. But at its heart, you have to have that first person narration. And so by including Gonzo as Charles Dickens, you can have all of these fun lines, and they fit, and they're played for comedy, which Dickens is doing all the time. He's got puns galore in there and just hamming it up for the audience. And so Gonzo as Charles Dickens is part of what makes Muppet Christmas Carol work.
I support argument number one. As an English teacher, I support that.
Yeah.
I'd be curious if Rosalind has anything to say about that. I don't know how intimately aware you are of the Muppet Christmas Carol. It's obvious to me, having listened to you talk about this, that like you're quoting lines of dialogue from the book, and like you were serious when you said it's become a religious sort of sacred text for you. Does your relationship with the original text help you appreciate having Gonzo as Dickens in the Muppet Christmas Carol?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really fun to have him there. And actually, you know, Dickens does break the fourth wall in at least one place in the novella. He has a line somewhere where Marley says, I've been with you all this time, right? I've been with you and near you, you just haven't seen me. And he says, yes, reader, as close as I am to your elbow now as you read this, right? So he has this moment where he breaks the fourth wall and says, my spirit, the spirit of the author, is with you and is accompanying you as you read this. Just as Dennis was saying, he wanted this to change us, right? He was changed by what he read about the plight of children, and he wanted that to change us, and he was going to be there at our elbow to prod us, right? I think to have Gonzo there specifically as Dickens to break that fourth wall worked perfectly and beautifully in line with Dickens's own willingness to be creative with narrative strategies. And of course, you can't forget the rat. Is it Rizzo? Rizzo the rat.
Yeah, yep.
Companion and gets up to all sorts of hijinks in every scene.
And he's great as like the unwilling audience participant who does not want to do Christmas carols. This is all just so great. But yeah. The second argument that this article made is that a lot of the characters, Dickens is known for his caricatures. Like, he's not known for subtle people. He is known for flamboyant stereotypes, just go the whole nine yards. And it's hard for actors to convey that a lot of them try to make Bob Cratchit be sympathetic or whatever. He just doesn't have a lot of character to him. He's a stereotype. He's a caricature. And guess what? The Muppets are as well. And so that's why the Muppets can embody these characters so well, is because Kermit the Frog is already the embodiment of wholesomeness and patience and long-suffering. And so he just fits right into that same archetype. And so we're already used to the Muppets being archetypes. And so they fill in these archetypical characters so well. It just matches. So that's the other argument. And it is truly a great adaptation, which honestly shouldn't have worked as well as it does. And it just does.
I mean, how can you not adapt that when you have a character like Fozzie Bear in the Muppets and you have a character like Mr. Fezziwig in A Christmas? It would be a crime not to do it.
Absolutely.
I wish they had done more, because I also love Muppet Treasure Island. Like, I want more Muppet versions of classic Victorian literature. It would be great. Let's do it.
You know, the one thing that the Muppet Carol can't do, can't really portray the ghostliness and the darkness. There really is moments of great darkness and horror and terror, as you say, right? That moment when Scrooge sees his own gravestone, right? And he sees his own deathbed. Those are scary. They're horrifying. They're meant to drag to the core. And that's an emotional range that the Muppets can't quite achieve. But it can make up for it in the goodwill and the fellow feeling and the jolliness. It certainly can even give Dickens himself a run for his money in producing those emotions in the viewer.
I think that Dennis, the look on Dennis's face when I edit this for video, I'm going to have Dennis's face going while Rosalind's talking, because he completely disagreed about something there. Dennis, go ahead.
The Muppet Ghost of Christmas. Yeah, the comic is pretty scary. He's 9 or 10 feet tall, and he's got the big, pointy, bony finger. He's pretty scary. He's not as scary as 1970 Scrooge, but he is pretty scary.
Where, I forgot to mention, Scrooge literally goes to hell, and Marley is like, "You did such a good job that Lucifer himself wants you to be his personal clerk."
And you know what? When I was a kid, I told you, right? This scared me to death. And him falling into his grave, and he falls all the way to hell. And I remembered that scene. And then I saw it edited for television, and they had cut out the hell scene. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that he fell down. My wife's, "No, that never happened. He didn't do that." I'm like, "No, he did. I swear. I saw it."
Oh, my goodness.
The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come is the weakest part of the Muppets, right? We have a bunch of the no-name ugly Muppets that nobody really cares about, because there's no one in the Muppets repertoire who fulfills that dread and grossness. That's just not a thing.
I just want to draw attention to that moment where Scrooge is pleading for his life. Dickens is such a genius and such a master at moving the reader from one end of the emotional spectrum to the other. And I am moved every time I read that passage where Scrooge is pleading on his knees for his life in true desperation and true existential despair. And without that moment, that I think maybe only the novella truly achieves, maybe some of these other versions have, but without that, and then he goes directly into Stay Five, right? The final five. And he wakes up on Christmas morning, and just the absolute relief and delight and gratitude and just overwhelming joy that he feels. I think only if you've been with him in that moment of despair and dread can you really understand the change that's been worked in his heart. So this is just yet another fangirl plug for Dickens' work of genius in A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
It was fun to read the original, and I've been inspired by your love for it and might need to make that a part of my regular Christmas tradition as well. So thank you for that. All right. I think that wraps up our discussion. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. I'm Carl Cranny on Twitter, as long as Twitter's still around. That's where you can find me. We'd like to thank our guests for joining us. Liz, where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, you can follow my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com, and I'll update my social media links on there as we watch the downward spiral of a certain website.
That's right. Dennis, if people wanted to find or get a hold of you, how could they do, if you have anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I have nothing to plug. I am the least social media present person in the room. I think my 80-some-year-old grandmother is more social media savvy than I am. So anyway, you can't find me there, but you can always find me in my office.
Great. Love it. Rosalind, where can people get a hold of you if they wanted to? Is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I'm not super active on the socials, as they say, either. Feel free to Google me if you're interested. You can find my BYU email address. I always welcome correspondence by email. I used to blog on a blog called Times and Seasons. I'm sort of ghost of Christmas past around there these days, but certainly there's quite an archive of writing that I've done, including, as I recall, I think I've done a post on A Christmas Carol there. So feel free to check that out.
Thanks for joining us this episode. Next time, we will be discussing The Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, the Amazon Prime adaptation of Tolkien's Second Age mythology of Middle-earth. J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay serve as showrunners, and I was excited to find out that Payne is actually a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So be ready for that conversation next time. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.